I'm David Kern.
I'm Heidi White.
And I'm Sean Johnson.
And you are listening to Close Reads, a podcast for the incurable reader, on which we are discussing J.R.R. Tolkien's The Hobbit, one of the best books. We're going to spend the next month or so digging deep into this rich text. First, though, Sean, how's it going?
Going well. David, how are you?
I'll tell you, I'm excited to talk about this book because...
Yeah, how could you not be?
Well, I'll talk about that in a minute, but I'm excited to talk about this book. Very, 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 very busy in my life right now in the world. And so this is like a great time to take an hour and talk about a book I love with friends. I mean, like that's the best. So Heidi, thanks for being here. How are you?
Thank you. I'm doing just fine. I mean, we're a little sad today. Our parish priest fell asleep in the Lord last night. And so we have much sadness and grief, but also faith and hope in the resurrection. So it's a good time to be reading Tolkien.
Yeah. Well, we told you this off before we started recording, but we'll be praying for you. And if you're listening to this show and you think of Heidi's, what's your church's church called again?
Holy Theophany, and it's Father Anthony Carbo.
Yeah, remember the whole community in your prayers if you're listening to this and you're so inclined. Yeah. Two things I want to mention before we dig into The Hobbit. One is that we just recorded, the three of us, a conversation on Post After Postmortem, which is an Oxfordshire mystery by E.C.R. Lorak. And we recorded that episode. That is now up. By the time this Hobbit episode drops, that episode will be available. So if you are wanting to follow along or are following along with our mystery conversations over on Close Reads HQ, Post After Postmortem is available for you. You know, I forgot to mention, Heidi, I told you this, but Sean, I forgot to tell you that, you know, the inn that he goes to, the King's Arms in Stowe.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So Bethany and I, we were in England. We stayed in that inn for 2 days. So he's sitting there. We ate where McDonald ate. So I forgot to mention
that's
on the podcast.
Cool.
That's great.
I didn't. Yeah. I remember you had told me that, and I didn't know if you were like keeping it a secret.
No, I actually meant to bring it up.
Didn't mention it on the podcast.
It didn't come.
I don't know why you would keep that a secret, but.
I know, right?
Now you I do not have loose lips. I'm like, he does
anybody.
Not want to say that he's been there.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm going to respect that.
So it's funny though, because I bring that up now because it actually does have a Tolkien connection, because Stowe is Stowe in the Wold, and that is in the Cotswolds, and the Cotswolds are what inspired the Shire. And there is a tree there that has grown up, two trees that have grown up around the doors of this church in Stowe. And it inspired the doors in The Lord of the Rings. You can Google that if you want to, but it does have a connection. So next summer, we don't have the registration up for this, but next summer we are planning to do a Close Reads retreat in England with the Cotswolds as our base. I know you guys are as excited about this as
I am. It's going to be magical.
Yeah,
I'm like counting down the days already.
So be on the alert for when you can register for that. I'm in talks with this place that we really want to do it. And if we can get that ironed out and nailed down, we're going to open registration. But it has this big Tolkien connection. So we didn't really get into that in the Post After Postmortem conversation, but I figured why not mention it now? You know, here at the top.
Yeah, also want to mention Post After Postmortem conversation.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Post After Postmortem. Also, as of last week, as of the day that we're recording this, actually, a project that my wife has been working on, Bethany's been working on for years now, is available for pre-order. And all I'm going to say right now is I'm very proud of her. It's a beautiful project. Graham designed the cover and designed a lot of elements in it. It's been a really great project to see happen and to get to help out with a little bit.
Tell us the name of it find it.
Yeah, I'm working. I'm getting there.
Where can I get it?
Well, you said all I'm going to say is, and I am not respecting that. So
well,
the way I was with that. I respect you. But
yeah, no, I get it. It's called Lumen, and it's an art. Yeah, I got it. It's an art curriculum for loosely for kids, like say pre-K through eighth grade, but it could be used for anybody. Like I've been reading it, or you know, early editions of it, and learning a ton just as someone who's interested in art. And the idea is Lumen will be eventually 7 volumes, and it will be each volume will be about one of the elements of art. So this first volume is about line. So it looks at how line has evolved in art throughout history, starting with, you know, ancient Greek pottery and Roman, fresco. Well, I guess Romans didn't do frescoes, but from cave paintings to modern times, you could, any form of art you can think of, it's in there. Lots of it is ecclesiastical art. There's plenty of modern art as well, though, too. It's really great if you are interested in helping your kids learn about the building blocks of art, like how to speak the language of art, and learn when they see something is beautiful, being able to express why it's beautiful and why it works, then this is a great thing for you to grab. Right now it's on pre-order. Till April 3rd, we are doing free shipping and 10% off. So if you want to grab the book and then also the art prints that go with it, which is, we recommend having the art prints, especially if you're doing it in a group, then, you know, check that out. If you go to goldberryarts.com, you can find out more. You can read some of the information she's written on it. You can also go to goldberryarts.substack.com to check her newsletter out on that. But it's a great project. She's been working very hard on it for more than 2 years. And it's you know, a first foray for us here into publishing generally. So there's a lot more that can be said about it. And eventually I'm going to try to convince her to come on and talk about it, but she doesn't like to do stuff like that. So, you know, we'll figure it out, but check that out. Again, it's goldberryarts.com. So, were you going to say something, Heidi, just a second ago, or were you just going to yell at me and tell me to?
No, I'm just really excited.
Me too. It looks
great. I'm
jumping
up and down. Imagine, listeners, that I'm jumping up and down. I'm not, but imagine.
It's hard to jump up and down while sitting.
Right.
It really is. That's limiting me right now.
I feel like a goblin might be able to do that, though. Oh, yeah. The way they run.
Maybe.
So, The Hobbit, right, guys?
Right.
Am I right? Sean, how many
another thing I'm excited about.
Yeah, right. How many times have you read The Hobbit, Heidi?
I don't know. Many times. I mean, probably not more than 10 times, but I couldn't name the amount of times under that. I read it to my kids several times.
Yeah.
Read it myself, listened to it.
How many times have you read The Lord of the Rings?
Fewer times. Maybe. I think probably 4.
Okay. All right. Well, The Hobbit is more consumable,
shorter,
in the sense that it's shorter. Sean, what about you? How many times have you read it?
Probably between 10 and 20 times. It's also, I have read it for myself. I've read it to my kids. It's also a one that we have on regular rotation in audiobook format. And so if I put together all of the snatches of The Hobbit that I've heard my kids listening to, the number probably goes up dramatically.
Like 1,000. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
So,
yeah.
Which audiobooks do you guys listen to? Because this is a big topic, and I'm listening. I'm kind of switching back and forth for this particular reading.
Yeah.
Which one do you listen to, Sean?
I mean, it has traditionally always been the Rob Inglis one, which in many ways I think is still phenomenal and unrivaled. But I do like the Andy Serkis recordings that came out in the last few years.
Heidi, which one have you listened to? Have you listened to the Andy Serkis one?
I have it downloaded. And I think that the last time I listened to it, I listened to that one. But usually it's been the Rob Inglis.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
that's the one my kids grew up on. It's not quite the voice of their childhood the same way that Jim Dale is from Harry Potter.
Harry Potter, yeah.
Yeah, but that's what Lucy always says, the voice of my childhood. But Rob Inglis is a really common voice around our house, too.
Sean, could you say who the voice of your childhood is?
It's probably Mr. Rogers.
Jim Carrey. Julia Child.
Yeah, that's right. I was suckled on PBS.
Well, I've been listening to the Serkis one, and I've been going back and forth, and so I got to the chapter, which of course is in this section called Riddles in the Dark, very famous chapter.
Yeah.
And I had to listen to his part, to him reading it, because his Gollum is one of the great
things so good
in performance history. I mean, it's remarkable how he can make him seem creepy, but also imbue him with so much. Well, I was going to say humanity, but I don't know if that's the right word. But sympathy, you know, like
sympathy,
pity is, might be the operative term. So, of course, The Hobbit came out in 1937 by J.R.R. Tolkien. It was been recognized as, you know, it's one of the best-selling books of all time. Makes all the lists. Generally, perhaps incorrectly considered, you know, juvenile fiction. I want to talk about that.
Yeah.
A little bit. You know, let's talk about that now. It's generally said, oh well, it's more of a book for kids than The Lord of the Rings. And I want to talk about that aspect of it. How do you guys think about this in terms of its, you know, YA or juvenile fiction aspects?
I think it is. Like, I think that it's written in a more lighthearted and playful tone. The narrator...
Then Lord of the Rings, you mean?
Then Lord of the Rings, okay. Yeah. And the narrator's continually speaking to us the pages in a different way. He doesn't do that in Lord of the Rings. And there's things that the narrator doesn't know. The narrator of The Hobbit doesn't know, like where Gollum came from and things like that make it much more childlike. And also the weight of this quest is much lighter. Like it is an adventure in a way that Lord of the Rings is not. And
it's not about the end of the world.
Right. Yeah. They're not saving the world. They are. It's an entirely different kind of quest narrative. The stakes are lower. And so, it's a more childlike book. Notice I did not say childish.
Sure.
But childlike.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And the narrator is at times referring explicitly to sort of fairy tale tropes. Mm-hmm. Bilbo knew all about trolls, even though he had never met one. And
he was very self-aware about it all.
Yeah. And he tells Gandalf, about the different stock fairy tales that he's known for telling in the Shire. So it is a little bit more self-referential even, which is more in keeping with the juvenile tone. The diction, even, I think, is not quite as lofty. One of my favorite lines in The Lord of the Rings is this description of Aragorn having wisdom sat upon his brow and strength and healing were in his hands. And that kind of language is just not in The Hobbit. but Tolkien, and we can talk more about this later, we'll probably have to. Tolkien did go back after the writing of The Lord of the Rings, which was prompted partly by the success of The Hobbit, and edit parts of The Hobbit to...
Also him being a maniac.
Because he wrote The Hobbit, and then he was on it separately writing The Silmarillion, and it wasn't until his publisher told him, listen, guy, we're not going to publish The Silmarillion. We want a Hobbit sequel. that he ended up writing The Lord of the Rings and sort of drawing the two together. And so he did go back and make some minor edits, some major edits to bring The Hobbit more fully into the world of Middle-earth. So there are ways in which, in some sense, maybe he brought it a little bit further up toward whatever kind of fantasy genre or reading level you want to classify Lord of the Rings as. But I think it began as a story for his children, and it never really stopped being a story for children.
Yeah, if you read the introduction.
Children of all ages.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So if you read the introduction, it talks about how Christopher Tolkien's introduction talks about how their brother Michael recalled something about how one day J.R.R. Tolkien is standing at a fireplace mantle or something.
With his back
to
the fire.
Him a story. Yeah, and he says, I think I've got this story with these hairy footed people. I think we should call them hobbits. And he said that sometimes Tolkien would ask them, what to call things. And in this case, he was like, I think we should call them hobbits. And so he just had this vision in his head of what he wanted it to be. And, you know, as the first line of this book shows, and we got to talk about first lines in a little while. Yeah. Before we go at the end, we're going to cover that. It's amazing how fully fleshed out, how alive this world is from the get-go. And, you know, it's not surprising that Tolkien would have the imagination to do that. He probably was working on these stories and these ideas for so long, but the world itself is so real and vivid and consistently imagined. Like there's not really gaps in the world building very much already. I mean, he expands upon it so much more dramatically in future books, including The Silmarillion and all the other things that he was doing along the way. But what works best about this particular book? Like what makes The Hobbit, if you take it out of the larger Middle-earth project, the larger J.R.R. Tolkien goals for the universe projects, what makes The Hobbit a great novel? What do you got for that?
I think part of it is the tone that we were talking about that Sean was saying. It's It's just kind of delightful to be included and winked at by a children's author. J.M. Barrie does that really well, and Peter Pan as well, that to be, to feel like you're being told a story, like you're a child sitting at the knee of a storyteller. I think Tolkien does that just masterfully with The Hobbit. Also, a quest narrative is just so fun. And Bilbo he's a hobbit for sure, but he's an everyman too, right? Like if I were to go on adventure, I would bumble and fail like he did. I would try to be brave, but I would fall on my face. I would
you'd be thinking about your tea in your fireplace. And
I absolutely would be like, where is my avocado toast and sparkling water right now?
That's the 21st century American version of the things that Tolkien writes about.
Right. I forgot my warmy put for the microwave to put on my back in the middle of the night.
Where's my mug that has a USB thing that charges my coffee hot?
This would be me. I would have the same ambivalence about adventure. And so to see Bilbo go from this comfort loving hobbit to, you know, a worthy adventuring soul is like the human journey. Like we all want to be that. And then I also think it's the world building. Like Tolkien he's unparalleled. There's nobody like Tolkien for building a world.
Sean's just nodding. He's like, yep,
Sean. It's all true.
Take it from there. There's more, Sean. Say it.
I think another great thing is the pacing of the novel. It's so.
Yeah, I was struck by that this time.
It's so full and well paced. It's really kind of a picaresque. So there's a unifying plot and goal that the characters have, but they're always moving kind of chapter by chapter from one new encounter to another and meeting a new character or set of characters in a new location. But what I love, spoiler alert, if you haven't read The Hobbit. Sorry, too late. But what's great is that that's not just it's not cheap in the way that Tolkien employs that that genre or that means of organizing the plot, because it all comes together in the end, right? Each new encounter is a new thread that we know having read the book that he's going to tie into a big satisfying conclusion at the end of the story. I love that. But it never slows until it slows at the right moment.
Right. Yeah. Well, and of course, that's one of the things that people say about The Lord of the Rings is you get these long sections where it's not the forward motion kind of stalls. And Tolkien's doing that on purpose. It's not because he's a bad storyteller. He's bringing us specific places.
And also that doesn't happen as often as people who actually read the books, or no, who don't read the books, think it does.
Claim.
Read the books.
You get to one part that feels slow and you stop.
He spent through a half a sentence talking about trees. It's taking forever. It's not. It's always moving.
Well, I think one of the things that it is the reason for both of what you're saying, the reason behind the things that both of you are saying, is that it's from the perspective of Bilbo. I mean, I know that's not, he's not the narrator, it's not first person, but essentially he is our POV character. And so that makes it less lofty. Like, you know, The Lord of the Rings is the perspective of kings and wizards. Right. I mean, I know it's Frodo, but it's kings and wizards and elves and the world being close to an end and great evil. And you're along with, I mean, you're not even, there's a whole half of a book where there's no, like Frodo and Sam aren't even in it, right? So the hobbits are a key part, but it's not just their perspective. And here there's a sort of whimsy that stays attached to it, I think, because we stick so close to Bilbo. And he's not interested in those things. He's interested in breakfast twice.
Me too, Bilbo. Right. Same. And he just has like all these fun fairy tale elements and folktale elements that are expected and but not cliche at all in the hands of Tolkien. Like at the dragon, the trolls, the underground lairs, the goblin sword, like all of it. Those are common elements and stories, but he makes them fresh and interesting. And you have this sense of just being in the hands of somebody who knows what they're doing, and you know it's not going to be cliche. And there's going to be enough playfulness without any mockery of the storytelling, mm-hmm. right? It's not like this kind of modern, you're not like laughing at it.
Yeah, it's not
you're
ironic.
Just seeing it differently and playfully and fresh. So all of that just makes it delightful for parents and kids. And other people in the world. You don't have to be either one of those things. Any human will like The Hobbit.
You could have sprung up out of the ground fully formed. You'll like this part.
And if you read it to your dog in the right tone of voice, they also will enjoy it.
Indeed.
One thing I also love about this book is how English it is, in a way that even more so than The Lord of the Rings is.
Yeah.
In part because there is a wry English sense of humor to it, in part because Bilbo is straight out of the Cotswolds. I mean, right. The Shire is his whole perspective is very like countryside Englishman, but also the narrator is too. There's little bits of language and jokes and things like that feel so very like 1937 England. And the more English stuff I read, the more it stands out this time. Okay, but beyond the adventure, beyond the whimsy, what makes this a great book? What makes this book talkaboutable? I mean, we can always find things to talk about in a book, right? But like for you, what are the things that are most interesting to talk about in a book like this? No, let me rephrase that. In this book.
In this book, a book exactly like this one. So much like it, but no other book could be like this one. Yeah. I do really love the way that there is a mounting seriousness to the plot. So by the end, one of the themes probably a later episode is where this will be more convenient to talk about. I think Tolkien owes a lot of The Hobbit, of what's going on in The Hobbit, to Beowulf. And one of the themes that emerges by the end of the story is the dragon sickness that the dwarves have, right? Their lust for gold. That kind of comes with envying a dragon his treasure. And that's a very sort of adult theme that emerges in this initially very whimsical story. But it never, even there, it doesn't get beyond what a young reader can intuit or comprehend. That's one of the things I think that continually makes this a great book.
And when that's set up with Gollum,
right. Yeah, that's right.
I mean, the theme is not explicitly stated, but it's set up.
Yeah.
What about you?
I agree with everything Sean just said. I think that this book absolutely stands alone. And if Tolkien had not written a single other word, this book would still be read and discussed. But I think one of the things that makes The Hobbit even better is the fact that there are other books. It's the fact that it is the prequel to Lord of the Rings. And so in reading The Hobbit now, after knowing and loving Lord of the Rings more, like I love Lord of the Rings more than The Hobbit. There's, as you said, Sean, I thought that was really insightful. There is this sense of mounting seriousness. There's also this sense of a lurking kind of evil in this world that is not explicit, but all the more powerful that it's there.
Yeah, it's at the edge.
And counterbalanced with a goodness that is not explored in the novel, but that lurks within its pages, right? Mm-hmm. You can tell that this is one story, and the stakes are lower than a larger kind of enveloping cosmic reality that's surrounding this tale that you know in reading it that exists in this world.
Yeah.
There's all these references to things that happened later or things that, that Gandalf is there for fun, right? He's just there because he's going on an adventure, but you know that Gandalf is more than an adventurer. He is some kind of crusading power of the good.
Yeah.
And there's also a threat and a danger that's not being addressed that exists somewhere else. And The Hobbit has all of these threads within it. So you know that it's one story among many, and a lighthearted one, but there's a more serious one taking place. And I think that sense throughout the novel makes it more delightful, but also just makes it better.
Yeah. The stakes, or the at least the thematic stakes, get really heightened in the Gollum stuff because, and he, all the stuff that Tolkien does early in the book that makes it so, you know, like all the stuff of food and tea and naps and multiple lunches and dinners and all the things that Bilbo is longing for kind of come to fruition. They earn their keep, so to speak, in that situation with Gollum where he says, well, it's where he's thinking about attacking Gollum. It's right at the end of Riddles in the Dark, and it says, it was not a fair fight. Gollum had not actually threatened to kill him or tried to yet, and he was miserable, alone, lost. And then it says, a few sentences later, a sudden understanding, a pity mixed with horror, welled up in Bilbo's heart. A glimpse of endless unmarked days without light or hope of betterment, hard stone, cold fish, sneaking and whispering. All these thoughts passed in a flash of a second. He trembled, and then quite suddenly, in another flash, as if lifted by a new strength and resolve, he leapt. Well, leaped, I guess. And that's really interesting twofold, because on the one hand, it makes all those things that Bilbo loves, that we're kind of loving alongside of him, not just about Bilbo be loving comfort, but about those things actually being good in the world.
Yeah.
That they actually mean something. That there's like these quotidian goods that can be healing and preserving, and that in the absence of those things, Gollum falls into a sinkhole of despair and greed at the bottom of this, you know, the deepest part of the mountain. And then also when the memory of those things creates in him, or there's like a cause and effect between the memory of those things and the pity that he has, it also empowers him in the moment to escape. So there's like this, I think that's a really interesting pivot point in the story. I mean, I think it even says that when he finds the ring, it's a turning point in his career.
Yeah, we didn't know it. Yeah.
Which is a delightful line. It was what's his career? but in that moment, the memory of those things, those good things, becomes this like empowering and like morally, they're not morally neutral anymore in that moment. And that's where I think the themes of the story begin to get heightened and sharpened and like orient us towards something greater than just adventure. Were you going to say something, Heidi?
No, okay. But yeah, I like that. So. Sorry. Yeah. I just think that's right. Whenever I read this book, I feel very much like I'm submitting myself to something. And I think it has a lot to do with what you're describing. Like the author isn't just telling this story. This is one story in a whole world of stories. And so it makes me trust and it raises my curiosity that I'm like, really want to know what the narrator means that it's a turning point in his career. I want to know more about Gandalf. You can tell Gandalf is way more than the wizard that we see on this quest. There's lots and lots of references to other adventures, other stories, an entire culture, multiple cultures, an entire world. I'm even hard pressed as a woman in my 40s to believe that Middle Earth doesn't exist.
Wait, it doesn't?
It so has inhabited my imagination over the years. And there's still so many stories left untold that are referenced throughout, which is a bold move on the part of an author. And other authors have tried to do that, and it just kind of falls flat. But there's something about Tolkien's gift of storytelling, the breadth of his imagination that he's inviting us into through his canon, that I actually believe there's stories out there about Middle Earth that like really happened that just like he didn't get to write down before he died. And I'm like, well, someday we're going to know, right?
Well, Christopher Tolkien's been trying to prove that for 50 years.
Yeah, that's right.
Right?
Turns out.
I believe it. I'm all in on this. So I just think he's the master of world building.
I,
I think
you could make a case that if there's something, if a world that is quote unquote fictional, I don't know why I said quote unquote, except, you know, if a world is fictional and it can last in your imagination for, or in the collective imagination for 100 years, then I think at that point it just exists. I don't think that it's, you know, it's a, I think it's just, you know, a certain point. We, I mean, we can debate the notion of existence if we want, but.
But why bother? I don't think
we're here for that.
It's obvious.
Yeah, exactly. Sean, who's your favorite character in this book besides Bilbo?
Besides Bilbo.
Unless someone else is your more favorite character than Bilbo, you can express that opinion as well.
Sure. You know, it really, obviously it's a standout. There are certain dwarves that just sort of melt together and...
Keely and Feely.
Yeah, Keely and Feely, Oin and Gloin. I mean, I know that one of them, you know, gives birth to Gimli at some point, or sires Gimli, but... Other than that, what makes Gloin and Oin different?
I don't think that they give birth.
Yeah, I see. That's, I know. They spring up out of the ground with their beards already. But I, so, you know, some of the dwarves are kind of off the table because you can't tell one from the other. But I like Balin, and you can, you know, he definitely has a personality that, stands out. I think Gandalf is often the most amusing character. He's fun and lighthearted at times that even the other characters find it difficult to be fun and lighthearted. And he's also just a little bit more knowing, and that makes him a little crotchety at times.
Like when, be more careful.
When Thorin chooses, what does he say? Or he's put out, he's bent out of shape that Gandalf has the map and the key early in the novel. And he says something like, I'd like to know how Gandalf came by them. And Gandalf retorts, I didn't come by them. I was given them. And that sort of classic, I mean, this is the origin of it, I guess. But the classic Gandalf wry wit is always enjoyable. He's a scene stealer when he shows up, for sure.
I love those too, because like he doesn't, Tolkien didn't have to write any of that in. That's just purely to create character. And like, that's just has to come off the dome, right? That's that's just a creative, the genius just spilling out. Heidi, who's your favorite character?
I mean, probably Gandalf. But I'm like the weirdo who just really likes Thorin.
Okay. So the reason I bring this question is because I want to talk about it.
Yeah, I just like him. I tend to like the characters with like gravitas more than like the comic characters. Yeah. I just like them. Like they come, I just do. And I think that Thorin is a great character because the easy way would have been to make him like an Aragorn. Like too perfect. And to have him be this kind of like chosen one amidst these, you know, lesser beings. But that's not how Tolkien wrote him. And I just think that was great.
He's not quite either Aragorn nor Boromir. Like he's somewhere in between, like he's very flawed. But I think this book is not, I mean, this is obvious, but the book's not the same without him. I think you know what I mean. Like there's a gravitas not just to the character, but his gravitas lends a gravitas to the book, without which it would be, you know, Tom Sawyer with hobbits.
Right. I agree.
And wizards.
And wizards. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you need that. You need this counterbalancing weight of like a flaw. But you don't know you need it. It just adds so much to the book that that Thorin has this pride to him that is evident from the very beginning. Yeah. But so and I know we're not, I guess I'm just making this assumption that people have read The Hobbit. So I'm listeners, I'm so sorry. I am ahead of the reading in what I am saying. So I mean, forgive me. Fine. I won't. Yeah. But I remember the first time I read The Hobbit and being very surprised by Thorin and at first not liking it and kind of like, I don't want him to be like the hero. I need him to be the hero.
It's sad.
I want him to be the hero. Because Gandalf's coming in and out, like, who's the hero? And then kind of like giving way to that and realizing how good that is of a move on our storyteller's part.
Well, it allows so much contemplation, so to speak, of what it means to be a hero. I'm not saying Tolkien wrote a book that's like, I'm going to write a book that contemplates what a hero is.
Yeah, if you want to know what a hero is, read Lord of the Rings. Those are all heroes. Like, he's not afraid of giving us heroes. Right.
Well, in a way, Bilbo's trying to figure out what it means to be a hero too. Yeah. And Gandalf, you know, all these different models of what it means to be a hero and not be a hero, and how you can be a hero up to a point and then your fatal flaw dooms you to no longer be a hero.
Right, and how do you come back from that and all of that? It's great.
Sometimes you don't.
Well, and that's by design, right? One of the things that Gandalf throws off at the beginning of the novel that becomes more significant later is, killing the dragon's going to be a little bit trickier. For that, we would need a hero. And I looked around and I tried to find some heroes, but they were all busy off in distant lands fighting each other. Which is kind of a jokey throwaway line. And a nod to the genre, like usually this kind of story has a hero and we're fresh out of heroes. But then it is the various ways in which several of the principal characters have to come to terms with what it means to be a hero and emerge as heroic in their own right.
Well, speaking of heroes, I'm just waiting for someone to write that think piece / hit piece on why Gandalf was actually unethical in the way he drew Bilbo into the adventure. Bilbo didn't consent for the adventure. You know, I mean, he really does. He really just kind of gets swept away into it and doesn't have a choice.
No, when he reads that note on the mantle, it's tacit consent to a contract. He's in.
Once he reads it, okay. He reads it and walks out his own door.
Yeah.
You know what I was thinking?
You had a legal argument at the ready, Sean. You have thought about this before.
I've had to read this book with teenagers before. So.
I was really thinking a lot about what the state of his hobbit hole is going to be when he gets back. Mercifully, Tolkien did allow him to clean up
the dishes.
and that's why he's late. But the dusting is going to be a real issue. I mean, his larder is going to be moldy. I hope he does some good preservation. You know, I mean, he's a hobbit, so I imagine and he's underground. So
I'm sure his canning fermenting game is pretty strong.
Yeah, right. I've had another question.
I do think the party is pretty stressful.
Oh, yeah.
Whenever, every time I read, I'm like, man, I just need to have more snacks available in case an adventure befalls me at any time.
Well, and really hosting any group of people that wants to eat copious amounts of food is an adventure.
Yeah, that's right.
As both of you know. I mean, I love it. They all have their very specific things. That's one of my favorite things about this book. A little red Gandalf says he wants not tea, he wants wine. And then Thorin says, and for me.
So does
and
Thorin.
Then Biffer says, raspberry jam and apple tart. And then Boffer says, and mince pies and cheese. And a pork pie and salad, said Bomber. And more cakes and ale and coffee, if you don't mind. Put on a few eggs and then bring out the cold chicken and the pickles. And the specifics of it are so long and extended. And it's always like, well, I think I have some of that. Like none of them was like, no, I'm sorry, I'm out of the seed cakes. It's, I baked two seed cakes this afternoon. So...
for my after supper morsel.
Yeah, exactly. He is very well prepared, and he lives by himself. That's my favorite part about the whole thing. It's not like
life.
He's planning on hobbits showing up. Yeah. I mean, dwarves showing up.
I just think like entire treatises can and probably are. I know are written about food in Tolkien's canon.
Yeah.
Like it's so important.
Yeah.
And one of my favorite things about Tolkien is that is that Middle Earth has this entire existing culture that is not defined by its problems. Like the problems intervene, right?
Yeah. Yes.
But they have a way of life. And that way of life is founded on human things that a way of life should be founded on. Storytelling and music and food and drink and, right? And song and sitting around the fireside and... dishes and all these things that are just ordinary life that like everybody who reads these books wants to be a hobbit or an elf without exception, right? Because they have this beautiful way of life that you care about so much and we find ourselves with the characters wanting to preserve it.
Mm. Yeah.
And I think that's one of the things that makes him a great world builder. Of course, the language, of course, the geography, of course, all those things. But other world builders do that, right? But it is that he creates a way of life that draws us as the reader in because it's like ours, but better.
Yeah.
And we just want to save it and preserve it and enter into it and create it for ourselves. Like I read this and I'm like, I'm going to go bake some banana bread.
Yeah. It's not an accident that the world he first introduces us to and asks us to care about and want to preserve is a simple way of life.
Yeah.
It's not right. People who have lofty goals or they're trying to build, massive cities or whatever. Those cultures, even in Tolkien, they rarely end well unless it's Rivendell, right? And then they're basically going away to be secluded from it all.
Yeah, it still gets old and disappears.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the hobbits, he introduces us to people who have simple goals, whose culture is defined by, and I don't mean simple in a negative way or like small things. I mean, I guess that's the whole thing about the Lord of the Rings, right?
They're ordinary and people wholesome.
Save the day with the help of people that are extraordinary. But I do want to talk about first lines here in a minute. So we got to save a little time for that here at the end of the episode, because I hear Tell you may have opinions on some things. No.
True.
No. Sean's like, no, I would never. And he's like, yes, absolutely. Do you have a favorite scene in this first section? Heidi, you mentioned the meal at the beginning, the party, is it as simple as that? Or is there another scene that for you is the one that you, when you're getting back into this book, you're like, oh yeah, this is a good part. It's like when you're flipping channels, and the movie's on that scene and you're like, yo, I'm in now.
I just think it's one of the greatest first chapters in literature. It's just great. It's so fun to read. It has everything Tolkien, like, it's just great. Yeah,
food and music.
It's so satisfying. Yeah, and adventure and
witty repartee
and
maps.
Yeah, and Gandalf. Yeah.
Runes on doors.
It's just, yeah.
Yeah, I agree.
But it's a great introduction to the story and the pacing. We've already talked about the pacing. It's awesome. I just love it. It's delightful.
I want to say something about that because I've read this book a lot over the years. I mean, I read it as a kid. My dad read it to us multiple times. We listened to the audio dramas and audiobooks and all that kind of stuff. But reading it this time, I was struck by how quickly everything happens. And maybe that's because in my head somewhere, those terrible Hobbit movies got stuck, which adds a bunch of extra stuff.
Oh, Lord.
But I mean, I'm being facetious, but it really is like bang, bang, bang. He's not messing around in terms of the plot. And that's probably where maybe it's most like a children's book.
Yeah.
It's high level writing, but he's not asking us to like extend our patience beyond the point that like a 10-year-old would be interested in doing.
No, it's not 90 pages to cover a dragon in gold or something crazy like that.
Well, Sean, what about you as far as
scenes go? And if you don't know what I'm talking about, God bless you. There are set pieces that I really love. I love the trolls.
Laughing out loud.
That whole little comedy vignette is great. Sometimes it's the little touches, though. I love when Bilbo rushes out of his house, when he finally does commit to the adventure and he runs off. And then as they're getting on the road and he's seated on his horse, right, he realizes he doesn't have his pocket handkerchief. He doesn't have his pipe. And then along comes Gandalf, who has brought those things for him. He brought his pipe. He brought his tobacco. Yeah. Just that Gandalf is both urging Bilbo into this adventure at breakneck speed, but then always showing concern for Bilbo, having gotten him into the adventure. those little details are great. And then again, when Bilbo awakens in the goblin tunnel, and one of the first things he does is to feel around and make sure his pipe isn't broken. So Bilbo's unflagging concerns for those small comforts and pleasures of life make me smile every time.
And then you get, of course, the Gollum stuff, Riddles in the Dark, which right. is one.
Yeah,
of,
I mean,
which is an incredible scene
of all time. That's like a Hall of Fame literature scene. Period.
It's downright Shakespearean in some ways.
Yeah.
The way it plays with your expectations and the psychology of it, and you know, it even makes the point to say that Bilbo kind of stumbles into the question about what's in his pocket. He didn't mean it at first, and then he's like, "Well, I guess I got to go with it." And then he starts to wonder if it's the book starts to ask you to consider whether that's actually fair, but then you want him to survive. And so
is this already the ring working on him, right?
And then Tolkien doles out very slowly the nasty parts of Gollum's character too. So that just as you start to think, maybe Bilbo's not being fair there.
Yeah,
then
he had a grandmother.
But then he's like strangling goblin children. You're like, oh, they're goblins, but they're children. Oh, I don't know if I like this guy.
Yeah. And then, of course, the language in the scene is incredible. And I did mean to ask you, how are you guys with your riddles right now? Like, are you feeling like you have a good catalog of riddles you can turn to?
Dreadful. I would have been dead.
You know,
like immediately.
You'd have turned into the blade.
This is a whole skill, like British skill. This is a whole like English subculture thing.
That's right.
That man, no, I'm really not good at thinking on my feet, actually. This is a confession I'm making in public.
Brushy podcast.
I don't know. I don't get it. Yeah. So,
Sean, like,
I'm not for
how
riddles.
Are you with riddles?
He's probably good. I'm at okay. It. I don't have a very good stock of riddles in my head, but I can usually make my way through one.
You mean like you can make it up as you go along, or you can get the answer?
That I can get the answer.
Okay.
But I don't want to promise that.
Hey Sean, what have I got in my pocket? Actually, in this case, I have both nothing and a knife, depending on how you look at it.
Oh well,
and your hands probably.
Yeah, I thought we had established already that was an unfair question.
I couldn't see it.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, lint. I don't know why the Gollum just didn't guess lint.
What kind of?
Well, I mean, he cheated. It's a cheat. It's a cheating question.
It's true, but he didn't intend it as a cheat.
But
he does go through with it.
That's true.
But he does go through with it.
It's true. But it's so subtle on Tolkien's part.
Oh, yeah.
Like, nobody gets the ring fairly, right? Like, not even our best character. Like, it is not... Bilbo's not a ring bearer the way that Frodo becomes a ring bearer. Because he doesn't get the ring fair and square. And it's not his fault. Like, he didn't do it on purpose.
Right.
But I think that Tolkien is a genius for putting the ring into Bilbo's hands in this way.
Yeah. Though he doesn't use violence to keep the ring.
Right.
Which is also important.
And he has pity, right?
Yeah.
Which later on Gandalf
key,
says.
Yeah.
Like, it is pity that stays his hand, pity not to strike without need, because the ring, his ownership of the ring began thus, right? The pity of Bilbo may rule the fate of many. And that is evident here. Like, you can, and that's what I meant earlier when I said this book is even better in light of the rest of the canon.
Yeah.
When you're reading it very carefully now, it's close reading.
Oh.
You see Tolkien's light heart but deft hand.
Mm. Yeah, well said. It sharpens and heightens the stakes that are there. Well, we'll talk about plenty more with this book, and we can get into the ending more specifically when we come to it. Let's talk a little bit about some first lines for a few minutes before we go, because our 2024 close reads bracket, our bookish bracket, is out. It's called One Line to Rule Them All, and it's a bracket in which for openings to great literature pit it up against one another. You can go to closereads.substack.com. If you have never seen this, then you can vote, you can participate. By now, the first round is over, so you'll have to vote if you have not yet done so in the future rounds. Sean, what's the one that got away for you based on the voting right now? Most of the voting is pretty set. I mean, I know we still have some time. A few swings could happen. 12th Night could have a comeback. It's only 4% behind Richard III.
Yeah.
That could happen, but most of them are fairly settled. So for you, what makes you sad?
You know, I'm going back right now to see how things are standing. The Winnie the Pooh, I'm a little sad to see that one go. I'm gonna make some enemies here, but as awesome a book as The Fellowship of the Ring is, it doesn't have a very spectacular opening line. But Madeline's opening line is so iconic, and it rhymes. So that one I'm a little sad to see. Last, I'm scrolling down feverishly to see, oh, good. I have a line that I know is not going to win this thing, but I'm hoping to see it go a little ways. And it was a close race. It was still a close race. Ooh. I'm not even sure if I want to say what. So I like both of these lines that are pitted against each other, which is too bad. But I am a big fan of the opening line of the Napoleon of Notting Hill.
Oh yeah, those ones. That's a tough choice.
Yeah, it's up against Douglas Adams. That's always tricky.
But there.
Yeah, that one was always going to go either way. I think.
Well, it's 51-49, and when I checked earlier, it was 51-49 the other way. So that's touch and go. We'll see where it is when people listen to this. Heidi, what about you? What's the one that got away?
I think I know. How can the Iliad?
I don't know.
Be losing. I don't know. How can
to anything? I know. Yeah.
Like the fact that we're not even getting three epics through to round two is, here we go, listeners. If you have voted against these, for shame. These are the greatest openings in world history. It's like voting against "In the Beginning" was the word. You let the epics go down. This is shameful.
The Aeneid is losing to Carson McCullers too, which is, I mean, I love Carson McCullers.
That's a pretty good opening line, though.
It's true. But Heidi, you know whose fault it is. It's David's fault.
It's not. Well, it is in the sense, but you know, the epics are like ones and two seeds in this bracket. So I'm trying to anticipate a little bit. And so
you want some upsets.
I did not anticipate
There was a time that Dante was behind.
Yeah,
that was crazy. When I first voted, Dante was behind, and I was like,
they're behind Daniel Nyerere.
We have failed. I'm going to like hang up my hat and go into despair. And I still am considering it. If you voted against the Iliad and the Aeneid, I need an explanation.
We get it if you voted against Dante because Daniel Nyerere's opening line is pretty good. Is that what you're saying?
No, oh. Daniel Nyerere will punch us for that.
If you voted against Dante, well, then you got to put him in your list. If you voted against Dante too,
in the middle of my life, I found myself in a dark wood. There's nothing truer than
that's right. And not just my life, our life.
That isn't.
It's your life too, people.
Yeah.
You know which one I'm upset about? Well, I've got a bunch actually.
Yeah.
And it's gonna. It happens every year. Anne of Green Gables knocks out Shakespeare. And listen,
it's not a good line. It's just the beginning of a story.
It's not.
I wish.
I don't even care where Mrs. Rachel Lynde lives. And Anne of Green Gables is my favorite book.
Mrs. Rachel Lynde can go take a long walk off a short pier. That's right.
Well, that's kind of like, maybe this is just proving, though, that it's a good line, because that's what everybody wants her to do in those books. But I will say, I believe that Hamlet, opening with the line, "Who's there?" is genius.
Genius?
It's one of the best.
Totally agree.
If it wasn't Hamlet opening a story with "Who's there?" is a great line. And then when you take in all the psychological depth and questions that are at the core of that play, it's one of the great openings ever. So that makes me sad. I thought this was going to be the year when Anne didn't push through.
If Anne beats Pride and Prejudice and Anna Karenina and Eustace Clarence Scrub, I don't even know.
We should be voting based on opening lines here, people.
And I love Anne of Green Gables.
And next we'll be up against Fahrenheit 451, which beat Henry V, which I think is a troubling one.
That one, that We got to talk about that one because also ridiculous.
And may go a ways because I don't know that people are going to vote against it. Like Moby Dick, I mean, people might do Call Me Ishmael because it's famous, but I don't know.
It's a famous line, but it's a meh line.
And made it in because of the preliminary voting.
Yeah.
As the play-in seed, and you know, play-in seeds do make it kind of far in the tournament often. Now let's talk about a couple that. Well, I'm also a little sad that Catcher in the Rye didn't make it because I think it's
that's such a good opening line. But you pitted it against David Copperfield. I didn't know which way that was going to. That was actually a good choice, David.
David Copperfield in the line, so I was practically the reason.
And David Copperfield is iconic, so I do get that. But man, the Catcher in the Rye opening line, so good.
So two of my favorite lines of all time are still in it. And one of them is this one. Into the face of the young man who sat on the terrace of the Hotel Magnifique at Cannes, there crept a look of furtive shame, that shifty hangdog look which announces that an Englishman is about to talk French. It's one of my favorite opening lines.
That's a good one.
That won't make it too far, but I do like it as far as modern novels.
It is good.
I mean, the Hobbit one is good. In a hole in the ground, there lived a hobbit, and so forth.
Yeah.
It's very good.
I'm sure... in the end, it'll be like Dickens versus Austen or Anna Karenina or something like that. I mean, Pride and Prejudice.
Well, and that would be right. Like those would be actual good. And we do say it is all fair in the bracket. We do say vote by whatever criteria
choose. But this should be criteria applied to the opening line. People, be honest with yourself. So
is the problem here? I gotta.
People are gonna pick based on the book.
They're pick based on the book.
Is the problem?
I voted against Brideshead, people. Okay,
I know. So
no,
did
that
I.
Brideshead
and that was
that
hard.
Brideshead line is incredible. I think you're underrating that line.
Wow.
Especially again thematically. Now,
well, we're all just traumatized by the prologue.
Yeah, fair. So. When it comes to the epics, is the problem that the Aeneid, the Iliad, and the Odyssey are getting voted out? Or is the problem that that line itself to begin the Iliad is that good?
It is that good. Right. But I also understand if you're not familiar, you don't know why it's that good. I get that.
Yeah.
But the fact that 24 books of one of the greatest, most formative works of literature in the world is summed up in the first line it's a masterpiece. Like the whole epic is in that first line.
Kind of like Who's There?
Exactly.
And that's true for the Aeneid of arms and the man I sing, like rage, goddess, sing the rage of Pelt. They're masterpieces in and of themselves. But I do understand if you're not familiar with the epics, it's easier. It's low-hanging fruit, and I get it. But I'm just sad to see it go because I think it – I'm sad to see them go because I think it actually throws off the validity of the whole bracket.
So I almost – I had a
– it's like kicking Michael Jordan out of which the greatest basketball players of all time because you've never heard
of
him.
Well, depending on what you think of what happened in the mid-90s, that they kind of did. Or they may have. So what I almost kind of set a rule that it needed to be novels because I was having a really hard time with the translation aspect of those.
Yeah.
Because there's different iterations of the translation, but then I thought, they're so notable. We got to include them. Another of my favorite lines. Also Marley Was Dead to Begin With is an incredible line.
That's so great.
Yeah, it is. And that's good whether you know the story or not. You just read that and you're like, I'm interested.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, that's how I feel about this line from The Last Good Kiss by James Crumley, which is a 1970s crime novel. When I finally caught up with Abraham Traherne, and he was drinking beer with an alcoholic bulldog named Fireball Roberts in a ramshackle joint just outside of Sonoma, California, drinking the heart right out of a fine spring afternoon. I'm a fan of that line. There's a lot of stuff going on there. Anything? What are some of your favorites that are still in? Do you each have one that hasn't been mentioned?
Scrub.
Of course.
Oh yeah.
Scrub.
Yep. Don Treader.
That might win.
It's got a shot. That's a great one. I'm also obviously a big fan of The End of the Affair. It's a good opening line.
Yeah, that's a great opening line.
So I would put the odds on favorites right now at Pride and Prejudice. It's a truth universally acknowledged that a single man in possession of a good fortune must be in want of a wife. Like I'd probably give that make it a 3-1 favorite or something.
Yeah.
And then
Anna Karenina.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then maybe Eustace Clarence Scrub. Those would probably be the three.
Listen, I need some help. I need some help understanding how the opening lines to The Little Women are why I should care about the opening line of Little Women at all. Help me out.
Well,
it is the nostalgia for the book. They see little women and they go for it.
It's Beauty Metamorphosis. Christmas won't be Christmas without any presents, grumbled Joe.
Oh. That one is the hardest one for me. It's hard for me. That is one of the greatest opening lines. It's so good.
I mean,
it's such a horrible story. I mean, it's a great literary story.
It's miserable to read.
I understand that the story itself is miserably traumatic, but that line, Gregor Samsa waking up as a gigantic insect, that is so good.
It's losing to Joe lying on the rug. I like Joe. Don't get me wrong. Oh, boy.
I do. I think that I agree that, I mean, Metamorphosis should win that. It's close. I mean, even our friend Jesse, who Little Women's her favorite book, even she voted against even from Metamorphosis. Right, but yeah, I actually do kind of get why Little Women. I think it's a better line than you guys are giving it credit for in terms of what the rest of the thematically. But as far as there's no like insects in it, so can you really win? Although maybe Joe discovers an insect on the rug.
Maybe.
Maybe she discovers Gregor.
Waking up as an insect.
No, it's hard to beat that.
I'm going to write a matchup of those two books.
All of those super judgmental things that I said, I meant them. I meant them. But I am going to backtrack to the extent that I actually think nostalgia for a first line, like an awakening, it is a big, it's a valid criteria for voting in this bracket. And because the first line is doing what a first line should do, which is awaken a desire for the book, create an attachment, express affection, like that. So if you voted for Little Women over Gregor Samsa being turned into an insect, that would I accept that as valid. I accept nostalgia as valid because that's what first lines do. They attach you to the story. And so I think that people should absolutely be attached to Little Women and not Metamorphosis.
That's fair. That's fair.
Right? You shouldn't have like a nostalgia for that story.
Metamorphosis merch in your house. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Oh, Tale of Two Cities. That's the other front runner for sure.
I suspect our final eight will be Pride and Prejudice versus The Divine Comedy and Anna Karenina versus The Hobbit. And then I bet we'll have A Tale of Two Cities against, I'm going to guess, Christmas Carol or The Secret Garden. And then we'll probably have Anne versus Moby Dick. Wow. And then I'm guessing we'll have, it'll be Anne versus Voyage of the Dawn Treader in the other one. So I think once you get down, seven of those eight will be pretty good, right, Heidi?
Yeah.
I think
I am complaining, but it is very, it's good. It's going to be great.
Yeah. If even great. A few of these current front runners make it a long ways, it'll be an interesting competition. Yeah.
The whole point of this is to render people either comatose or angry. That's the whole point of these brackets.
I'm both alternating.
It's working.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we've got to wrap this episode up. We've got church services to go to and various things of that nature. If you want to.
Yeah, I need to go pray.
Enter
now.
Into the fray. You can go to, you can go to closereads.substack.com. Check out the bracket. Again, if you want to check out Bethany's project, Lumen, you can go to goldberryarts.com. And don't forget about all the other stuff we have going on, including the Daily Poem, which Sean has been doing on a daily basis, our ongoing conversations on Kristen Lavern Center for Close Reads HQ, and of course, our monthly mystery novels. We do not currently have a live poetry session scheduled, but we will get that on the calendar sometime soon for you. So be on the lookout for that. If you are supporting the show, thank you so much. Thank you also to Logan for editing these episodes and taking out all the times when we make mistakes. And
so many times.
Be kind to us in that way. So All right, guys, thanks. Anything else you want to say before we
My
go?
My husband waited 30 minutes to talk to me, and now he's driving off. He's been gone for 3 days. Oh, so sad. We're literally saying goodbye, and I'm like...
Just go out, just run.
Yeah.
Just run up that dirt road. It's a long road, so if you get around the corner, he can probably see you in the rearview mirror. And then it'll be like something out of a romantic comedy or something.
Yeah, yeah.
Because then you'll fall in the dirt, and he'll have to come back and carry you home or something. Any final thoughts on The Hobbit?
No. Okay.
I can't wait to read more Hobbit.
I mean, I have lots of thoughts on
Hobbit.
Yeah,
what a treat.
We got more episodes of that. If you'd like to, you can leave a comment in the section underneath this episode over on Substack as well, and we will potentially cover a few of those over the next few episodes. So, all right, well, for Heidi White, for Sean Johnson, I'm David Kern. Thanks so much for listening, and until next time, happy reading.